Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Naughton. I'd like to welcome you to this program. You're listening to the Progressive Commentary Hour. Once a week, we take on a serious topic, invite people who have something of unique insight to share on that topic, and we explore it in depth. There are no questions taken from the audience. Instead, every moment of this hour will be filled with something relevant. Today's topic, the plight of American children, abuse and exploitation, and the failures of our foster care and child protective services. My guest, Nick Bryant, journalist, investigative reporter, writing on the plight of disadvantaged children for over a decade. His writings have appeared in professional publications such as the Journal of Professional Ethics, the Journal of Applied Developmental Psychology, the Journal of Social Distress, and the publication of School Health. He is co-author of America's Children, Triumph of Tragedy, that dealt with the mental health problems of lower socioeconomic children. He is also the author of The Franklin Scandal, the story of power brokers, child abuse, and betrayal that exposes a nationwide pedophile ring that pandered children to a cabal of the rich and powerful and the corruption of the Justice Department and law enforcement to crack down on it. He is perhaps one of the most suppressed crime stories writers on this issue in American history. The website is franklinscandal.com. He is joined by Harvey Schweitzer. Harvey is an attorney with the firm Schweitzer & Scheer in Maryland. He has handled hundreds of adoption and foster care cases. He played a leading role in the creation of the Council for Child Abuse and Neglect Office at the D.C. Superior Court, and received National Treasury Award from the Foster and Adoptive Parent Advocacy Center. He received his law degree from UCLA and is an adjunct professor at Columbus School of Law at Catholic University. He is the author of Foster Care Law, which came as standard text in the field. His website is schweitzerlaw.net. Nice to have you both with us today.
Thank you very much.
It's good to be with you, Gary.
What we do on this program is a little different than many. I lay out a larger issue and then allow each person unlimited time to delve into the topic and have time for the contextual part of the answer. It's not necessary in this program to do little tiny news bites because it's not a chit-chat show back and forth. It's more like a classroom on the air. So here we go. I'm concerned that, at least in the field of medicine, many very conscientious parents have chosen either not to vaccinate their children or not to give their children chemotherapy or not to give their child HIV antibody drugs like AZT when the child was born to a mother who's been healthy and vital for 21 years. And these people all suffered in the same manner. Child services came in and said, we're charging you with child abuse. And that suddenly brought the full weight of the state or federal governments down on them. Frequently, their children were taken away and subjected to medical intervention without the parents' consent. Time after time, we have seen this happen. At the same time, we have seen enormous amounts of child abuse in the United States where something has to be done for the benefit of the child. The numbers are startling. According to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, 800,000 children younger than 18 reported missing, 200,000 children abducted by family members, 58,000 children abducted by non-family members. The first 3 hours are the most critical when trying to locate a missing child. The murder of an abducted child is rare, and an estimated 100 cases in which an abducted child is murdered occurred in the United States each year. Also, just from 1 year, 3,620,000 calls since it was created to a service, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. U.S. law enforcement agencies have seen a dramatic increase in cases of sexual exploitation of children since the 1990s. In 2006, U.S. attorneys handled 82% more child pornography cases than they had in 1994. And state and local law enforcement agencies involved in Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force reported a 230% increase in the number of documented complaints of online enticement of children in just a four-year period from 2004 to 2008. Also, in this same area, we have to look at what happens when a child goes into protective services. Is it a good environment or is it a Dixonian environment? The foster care statistics are bleak. Each week, 60,000 children in the United States are reported as abused or neglected. 900,000 confirmed victims. 520,000 of those children end up in foster care each year, double the number 25 years ago. 800,000 children every year come in contact with the foster care system. Over 40,000 infants are placed in foster care each year. On average, children stay in the system for almost 3 years before either being reunited with their families or adopted. Almost 20% wait 5 years or more. Children have, on average, three different foster care placements. Frequent moves in and out of homes of strangers can be profoundly unsettling for children, and it's not uncommon to hear of children who have been in 20 or 30 different homes. Many have been separated not only from their parents, but from their siblings. More than 20,000 children each year never leave the system. They remain in foster care until they age out. 30% of the homeless in the United States and some 25% of those in prison were once in foster care. The average age of a foster care child is 10. 40% of foster children are white, 34% black, 18% Hispanic. And the recommended number of cases for a social worker is 17. In some states, the number is four times that number. So we're going to begin with an opening statement from each person to give us your general overview. And I'd like to ask both of you, and we'll start with you, Nick, review how children end up in the foster and orphanage system and how does it basically work. And then I'd like for you to add your thoughts onto that as well. Harvey?
Okay. According to my research, as you were alluding to in the lead-in, Gary, America pays a great deal of lip service to its children, but it really doesn't put its money where its mouth is. Approximately 22% of American children live below the poverty threshold right now, and children are also the fast-growing segment of the homeless population. And over 7 million children don't have health care or health insurance in the United States of America. So what we're seeing, at least in my view, is a tremendous amount of carnage with children that are growing up. It's kind of like a wholesale destruction of children. There was a study performed at the University of Michigan by a researcher named Greg Duncan, and he found that if a child is born at a low birth weight and subjected to 5 years of continuous poverty, his or her IQ will be 90. So that will basically take them out of the game. From 5 years old on, they're basically taken out of the game. So this is a systemic and endemic problem within American society, is this wholesale destruction of children. The second book I wrote on children's issues is called The Franklin Scandal, and it was about a large interstate trafficking network in the United States. And that network pulled a lot of kids out of an orphanage, and that network also pulled kids out of the foster care system. And these foster care parents that provided this pedophile network with children, and this network also took part in child pornography too, they primed these kids. There was a lot of abuse in this, and particularly one of the homes where the first victim that came forward, she had been subjected to a tremendous amount of physical and sexual abuse before she was pimped out to this network. So there are a lot of problems in American society today with children. And I read a study a while back that concluded that 16% of American children or children in Western cultures get abused by someone in their family. And then when you go outside of the family structure, you've got priests, you've got Boy Scout masters, you've got teachers, you've got
predators like Jerry Sandusky. They're subjected to all kinds of predators outside the family system. So we're looking at a pretty endemic problem within our society, not only regarding the care, the proper care of children, but also the sexual abuse of children.
Thank you. Harvey, I would like for you to add your thoughts, but also add this. Child abuse as a medical concept is relatively new in the courts. What is this concept, and how is it defined and described as a medical condition?
Well, let me start with that, because a lot of people think that the terms child abuse or neglecting a child go back pretty far in legal history. In reality, they don't. I don't have the details in front of me, but at the Kempe Center in Denver, Colorado, I believe this was back in the 60s, there was a Dr. Kempe there who started to notice that he was seeing the same types of injuries over and over again in young children, in infants, and he started to make some conjectures, and again, I'm compressing a whole lot of history here, but he came up with the child abuse, the definition of child abuse as children who were being physically abused and physically injured by their parents. Up until then, we knew that, of course, children were, from time to time, injured by their parents. There was excessive corporal punishment. But child abuse as a medical concept, in other words, something that doctors and medical professionals ought to be on the lookout for, is relatively recent. And from that beginning started the expansion of what we now know as the Child Protection System, or CPS, which is an enormous endeavor in the state and local governments to identify when child abuse and neglect is occurring and when these cases should be brought into court. And, you know, you're asking some extremely broad questions here about how is it defined and how is it recognized, but the reality is sometimes these cases are very hard to determine if child abuse has actually occurred or not.
Okay. Harvey, I want to do a follow-up with that. Let's look at foster care. The average person has no idea what happens in foster care or what we call child welfare through the Child Protective Services. Give us an insider's look at that.
All right. The foster care system is designed to care for children who can't live in what we might call the biological family. They can't live with the mother, can't live with the father. A relative placement has not been found by the family. And these children are entering what we call the child welfare system to be cared for by the state, in essence. And what the state has done is recruit families, recruit men and women, recruit husbands and wives, couples, all different kinds of people to take children into their home. And these families are paid a stipend. In other words, they're not paid a salary, they're not paid any income to care for the children, but they're paid a stipend that is supposed to cover the cost of caring for the child, the clothing, food, water, the additional, you know, stress and strain on the household system. And this foster care system is an enormous part of the child welfare system. It's probably, when you count the medical care that foster children have, it's probably the single most expensive welfare program. In any event, the foster care system, as we now know it, replaced what we used to call orphanages. In other words, back in the 20s, the 30s, even into the 1950s, children were cared for in what we might call group homes, now called congregate care. And the foster home concept, as we now know it, was a relatively small part of how we cared for children. But orphanages, as they traditionally used to exist, don't exist anymore. Now what we have are, I would have to say, people who are motivated to do something good for children, step forward, they volunteer, they open up their homes to foster children. That's the main model that we use, are in essence people who volunteer to take children into their home and to care for them under the auspices of a state government or the county government, and there's a certain amount of judicial or court oversight. That's the main model. There are other models that have been proposed over the years that were experimental models or some demonstration programs that some states and some localities tried to implement. And this is, in general, a public operation. In other words, these foster care systems are operated by the state governments, by the county governments. There's been an awful lot of contracting out. In other words, there are a lot of private nonprofit agencies that provide foster homes and foster care to children under contract to the government. And then there can also be what we call the privatization model, which at times different counties or states have totally gotten out of the foster care operation itself and turned the whole thing over to either a private for-profit company to run the foster care system or nonprofit agencies. So that's the broad overview of foster care, which is, in essence, the state is raising children. And as much as I have seen a lot of compassion and a lot of good people attempting to provide good care for children, history has proven that the state is not a good parent. The state just cannot do the kind of job that we want the state to do to raise children. However, we're all struggling to find the alternative. In other words, what's the alternative to foster care? And you can propose different models, you can come up with different ways of providing foster care, but the reality is that, as you pointed out with your statistics, there is a sizable number of children every year in the United States who, for various reasons, cannot live at home with their parents and have to be cared for, quote-unquote, somewhere else. And what we're struggling with is, what's the best somewhere else to care for these children?
I appreciate that answer, Harvey. Thank you. I'm going to come back to you in a few moments, Harvey, to ask about our hearing stories of the state taking away a child for what the government defines as abuse, which can be refusing to vaccinate a child or give some kind of psychotropic medication, or getting caught driving without a license with a child in the car, leaving a teenager alone in the house, and we can expect definitions of abuse to increase as our nation becomes more medicalized. I'm going to ask you that when we return. But now, okay. Nick, you were on my show once talking about the Franklin scandal. I so hope that major journalists and news media would pick up that story, because it represented everything that I find is contentious and corrupt about our current judicial system. I want you to take a step-by-step through the Franklin scandal as an example of what has actually happened, fully documented, and this is not speculation, and tell us where everyone went wrong, mostly the FBI and the Department of Justice, in pursuing these high-profile child sex rings like the Franklin scandal, or even more recently. I'm really concerned that a Jeffrey Epstein, a billionaire who was close friends with Clinton and Gore, was caught on multiple child molestation with young, underage girls, and how he got substantially away with it, where other people who did not have his economic background, political connections, would have served a much different sentence. So at the end of this, tell us how the rich and powerful managed to get away with sex crimes. But first, the Franklin scandal in depth.
Well, the Franklin scandal is kind of a chilling, mind-boggling story, and had I not spent 7 years researching it, I would have real difficulties believing it. And the Franklin scandal is about a interstate pedophile network that trafficked children from coast to coast, and it was centered in Omaha, Nebraska. And as I was saying earlier, this network did get children out of an orphanage, Boys Town, one of the more notable orphanages in America, if not the most famous orphanage in the world. And they also got children out of the foster care system, and they also got children that just fell through the cracks. And the network was run by a shaker and mover in the Republican Party. His name was Lawrence E. King. And what happened there was he was flying children from coast to coast, and actually some kids did come forward and report that they'd been abused by King or minions of King, and the kids were simply ignored. And one of the first kids that came forward was in the foster care system, and she told a social worker that she'd been flown around the country to New York and Chicago and forced to perform sexual acts and watched other children forced to perform sexual acts. And the foster care people that initially dealt with her were actually, according to my documentation, my book is very well documented, and the first foster care person personnel that started to look into this foster care, this particular foster care home that was providing children, were threatened. And she said, according to the state legislator committee that looked into this, she told the investigator that she was threatened by the FBI to just drop her investigation. So ultimately, over the years, it took about 2 or 3 years, but these allegations eventually percolated up to the uppermost personnel of the foster care system in Nebraska. And they took these allegations to both state and federal law enforcement, and they were simply ignored. State and federal law enforcement didn't want to look into it at all. And ultimately, a Nebraska Senate subcommittee was formed, and they started looking into these allegations, and the foster care personnel provided them with a tremendous amount of documentation on this network, and they started looking into the network. And that's where, and these kids were pandered out to the rich and the powerful. And I've got flight receipts. I managed to acquire all the sealed or most of the sealed documentation of a grand jury that was used to cover this up. And I've got scores of flight receipts. And a number of the kids talk about being flown to Washington, D.C., and a lot of the flight receipts go to Washington, D.C. And ultimately what happened was there was a state grand jury, and I use grand jury testimony in my book to show just how corrupt that state grand jury was. It declared that there wasn't any child abuse, and then a federal grand jury followed in its footsteps and declared that there wasn't any child abuse. And actually there were two victims of this network that refused to recant their abuse. A number of the victims came forward were threatened by the FBI. The FBI were protecting some extremely powerful people. And ultimately, the two victims that refused to recant were both indicted for perjury. The girl, Alicia Owen, was indicted on 16 counts of perjury, 8 counts of state perjury and 8 counts of federal perjury. And she was 21 years old when she was indicted. She'd been enmeshed with this network since she was in early adolescence. And in the book, I talk about the kangaroo court that basically oversaw Alicia's trial, and she was indicted when she was 21. She was given 9 to 15 years for perjury. I mean, a kid. But it was important that they get her for perjury, that the judiciary get her for perjury, so it could sanctify the grand juries that said that there was no child abuse. And recently there was a case with Jeffrey Epstein, who was flying young girls around with various power brokers. It was very similar to the Franklin scandal because it took place in Florida, not in the Midwest, but there was a grand jury. The Palm Beach police had investigated Jeffrey Epstein for about a year, and they managed to get a number of minors to come forward and say that they had been molested by Jeffrey Epstein or friends of Jeffrey Epstein. And there was a grand jury that looked into those allegations too, and that grand jury didn't indict Jeffrey Epstein on a single count of child abuse. And local law enforcement in Palm Beach they just went ballistic, and they started screaming and for justice for these kids. So the feds came in and said that they were going to get to the bottom of it. And ultimately, there was they said that they were going to call it, the federal government said they were going to call it grand jury, but they never really did. And Jeffrey Epstein ended up getting a year and a half. He was ultimately indicted on one count of pandering a minor, I believe, and he had to serve 18 months in a county jail. And since then, he settled over 30 molestation lawsuits. So the Jeffrey Epstein and the Franklin scandal are really examples of the rich and the powerful basically abusing children with impunity or near impunity.
Let's go back for a moment. Explain what happened when these orphans would be brought out of an institution. Who would do it? How would they do it? And tell us the details of what would happen, specifically with powerful politicians in Washington. Who were these politicians, and what were their statements? How did it go down? Explain it in detail.
The kids that I've talked to, the first kids that came forward, actually the first girl that came forward, who was from the foster care system, said that she'd been flown around with Boys Town students, and ultimately, the state investigator found other victims, and those victims said, or the majority of those victims said that they had also been flown around with Boys Town students. And I managed to acquire a list of like 60 victims, and approximately 12 of them were Boys Town students, and then I eventually had to find them. And finding these kids was really difficult, because they were very marginalized. They'd come from lower socioeconomic backgrounds. They had been sent to Boys Town. They'd been repeatedly molested. And another thing that was involved here was drugs. I mean, if the kids did what they were supposed to do, they would receive drugs. And so these kids got very marginalized, and it was very difficult to find them. But the Boys Town kids that I found basically had the same story, that they met Lawrence E. King through other Boys Town students, and King recruited them, and they were given passes to fly to wherever over the course of a weekend, and they would be put in environments, generally in hotels or very nice houses, and there would be men there that would want sexual favors, and they knew what they had to do. And these were kids from very lower socioeconomic backgrounds. So the amount of money that was involved to get them to sell their bodies was actually very, very insignificant. And they all talk about these men at these parties. They did not know who the men were, but they said that the men wore finely, you know, tailored suits, and they were quite articulate. And that they had a certain charisma that and they were the perfect kids, because these kids had no idea of who they were interacting with. I mean, they would be flown to parties in Washington D.C., and they knew on some intuitive level that they were interacting with very, you know, probably politicians or very powerful men, but they didn't have a clue about, you know, who they actually were.
Were you ever in your investigation able to find the identity of the wealthy politicians or other people involved?
I was. Well, and here's one of the built-in mechanisms that it makes it very difficult. I mean, the names of some extremely powerful politicians have come up. But with these victims of this network, they're basically, as I said earlier, they come from lower socioeconomic backgrounds. And then when they reach a certain point in their adolescence, where Lawrence E. King no longer felt that they were marketable, they were expunged. And basically, they were drug addicts. Most of them were drug addicts and had been turned into drug addicts and repeatedly molested. So they went on to commit crimes and to compromise themselves. And a number of them, or some of them, have figured out who some of the people were, or eventually learned who some of these people were. But if you've got like a kid that's you know, struggled with drug addiction and has also been in prison a couple of times. And he says, I was with Senator Astor, I was with Senator Y. It's a, as far as credibility goes, it's a TKO in the first round, because these kids are just not going to be believed. And then the enormity of some of these people that they mentioned to me, it would almost require like videotape footage. But if someone reads my book in the context of the tremendous amount of power that was used to cover this up, and I'm talking two very, very corrupt grand juries. In my book, I show just how corrupt the state grand jury was. And there was also a very corrupt grand jury in Washington, D.C. that looked into these allegations or similar allegations. So if one reads my book and sees how much power was deployed to cover up these allegations, it's pretty obvious that people that were covering this up were pulling the strings at the pinnacle of power.
Okay, we appreciate you sharing that. Now, back over to you, Harvey. I'd like, if you would, please, to go into depth on an area that is rarely discussed, and that is with young children and teens all on the Internet and therefore making themselves available to would-be predators, aren't we finding child sexual exploitation increasing? And what can be done about that? And also, what happens to exploit a child once they're in the system?
The Internet has certainly increased the risk to children that they will be exploited. The Internet right now is, as I put it, the wild, wild west. It's very easy to get online. It's very easy to start to communicate with people. And unfortunately, not everybody on the Internet is there for the well-being of other people or to be friendly. And there are predators on the Internet. There are people on the Internet looking for vulnerable children to exploit. So far, nobody has come up with a cure for this or a prevention for this. Instead, what we try to do is to impress upon parents and guardians the need to monitor their child's use of the Internet. Who are they communicating with? Who are they going to be meeting somebody that they met on the Internet, and carefully monitoring that? And obviously, as we learn from the Franklin scandal, not all children have conscientious caretakers. Not all children have conscientious parents, and not all children are going to be living in an environment where there's somebody that's really going to be looking out for them. So the Internet, unfortunately, does give certain people access to children that they might not have otherwise. Law enforcement, it seems to me, is doing its best to track down, to identify, to arrest, and to prosecute people who are using the Internet for these, you know, immoral and illegal purposes. And how successful they are, you know, is a matter of a great deal of debate. It seems to me that it's quite easy to use the Internet to make contact with a child, and then to exploit that child. Unfortunately, the exploitation of children takes many different forms, and one form is the sexual exploitation by a particular individual. But this show started out by pointing out that 22% of American children are growing up in poverty, and poverty is a form of exploitation. And if you have a social system, if you have a population like the United States, where 22% of children, which is an extraordinarily large number of children, are growing up in poverty, then you're going to have, as these children grow up, significant problems growing out of the fact that they're in poverty. And one of the issues I would most heartily agree with Mr. Bryant is that the United States claims to be a nation that wants to do the best for children, but in reality, we're not really putting out there the funding that we really need to properly care for children and to address a lot of the problems that are out there.
Go back to the first problem that I'd ask you before we went over about the how the state can take away a child for what the government defines as abuse and even imprison the parents for refusing to vaccinate a child or give a psychotropic medication or chemotherapy. What is being done in that area?
Yeah, you're raising a number of different issues at the same time. Not all of the instances that you just gave me are going to be assessed by the child welfare system in the same way. Vaccination, chemotherapy, psychotropic medication are different manifestations of the kind of care the children are going to be getting. So let's try to narrow this down, and let's talk about a child living at home with a mother, with a father, or with parents. When is the state going to step in and intervene in the care of this child with regard to the medical care that the child is getting? The reality is that the state seldom steps in if the child is receiving at least adequate medical care. The cases that we read about, the cases that are picked up in the media, are those cases that are, I would say, at the margin in terms of, is the parent refusing recommended traditional medical care for a condition that is usually treated in the way that the doctors are recommending? Is this a situation in which the child had been responding to treatment and now the parents are stopping it? Or is it a situation in which the parents want to withhold traditional medical treatment for something that the doctors are claiming is experimental or hasn't been proven to be effective? There are cases, I will admit, in which the state seems to be overstepping its bounds, taking children away from parents who claim to be or in reality are acting in the best of faith, but the children may not be well served by the decisions that the parents are making. The term you use is abuse. In reality, the term that the courts would use would be it's a neglectful situation. The parents aren't abusing the children. They're neglecting the children because they're not providing proper care and treatment. These can be very subjective. In other words, one parent's provision of medical care is going to be slightly different from another parent, and then another parent, and then there are going to be some parents who, for whatever reason, aren't going to be providing traditional care. The state has some decisions to make. I know enough about child welfare and child protective services to know that these branches of child welfare are totally overwhelmed. They aren't looking for new cases. They aren't looking for parents who may not be giving the child the right dosage of psychotropic medication or engaging in some sort of off-the-grid treatment. They have their hands full with hundreds of thousands of hotline calls that are coming in. Usually the medical treatment cases are brought to the attention of child welfare by hospitals and doctors. Usually it's hospitals where they hotline a case in because a parent is refusing to care for the child in accordance with the doctor's advice, or they want to take the child out of the hospital and the child isn't ready to be discharged, or they're leaving the child in the hospital and the child is ready for discharge. So these aren't cases usually where the state child welfare is out there looking for parents who are doing this. These are cases brought to child welfare by the medical profession, by hospitals who want the state to intervene because they don't think that proper treatment is there. With regard to the vaccine issue, once again, we're dealing with a situation in which medical science has enabled us to prevent conditions and diseases that used to be endemic. And our government, our society, our culture allows the government to mandate vaccination of certain people, children, to get certain kinds of vaccinations. You can question that at some level, but on the other hand, if we're talking about a country that wants to properly care for children, and we are developing and have drugs, medication, vaccines that are going to prevent and cure certain illnesses, where do we draw the line between compelling parents to provide that care for children, allowing parents to do it, or punishing them when they don't do that. Some of these are in a gray area. One example, which wasn't as controversial as I thought it would be, is the vaccine that would prevent some forms of cervical cancer if given to young girls before they become sexually active. That's the first drug that I know of that prevents cancer.
Sir, let me just interrupt. We've done a whole award-winning documentary on this, proving that that is not the case, that that cervical cancer claim was completely unsupported. We have multi-award-winning reporters. We even have the person who developed it. I don't want to get you into an area that your facts are not accurate. Our facts are on this. We can deal with other issues that you are can be concerned about, but I couldn't stand by my evidence. No, I couldn't stand by since I've done three award-winning documentaries and have a new one coming out on Gardasil. And I'll be happy to share our research. I'll be happy to share any information to show you that you have 115 dead girls. You have more adverse reports than any other vaccine in American history. There is no science on it. It is based upon an abstract mathematical model. In any case, I won't go through that now. I'll just say that we have different information than what you've been privy to, and I respect your opinion on all these other matters. So if we could focus on any of the other issues, I would appreciate it.
Okay, well, the issue that I still want to focus on is the vaccination issue. In other words, when it is proven that a vaccine has a beneficial outcome for children and parents refuse to provide that vaccine, then that would be the situation where I think that the state would be correct in stepping in and saying, wait a minute here, we've passed this law here to mandate this vaccination. For the Gardasil situation, my understanding is that it's not mandatory anywhere.
They are trying to. Are you familiar with ALEC? The American Legislative Exchange Council. For 40 years, there are 300 major corporations working quietly and with all forms of committees. We're talking about major corporations who then meet on a twice-a-year basis with state legislators. They have passed thousands and thousands of laws. They actually give the bills to the state legislators. They sit and coach the state legislator on the importance of this bill becoming a law. The legislator goes back, gets other people to co-sponsor, has hearings, passes the bill into law, and no one knows that it was really behind the scenes were special interest groups. And the Gardasil is, but the manufactured Gardasil is but one of those. And we have many others that we could show that that's a lot of what we do in our investigation. So on the subject of vaccines, we would offer, if they could prove with real science and not the kind of science they've used up to this point, that a vaccine would be beneficial to that individual, I would agree with you. But as a scientist, as a PhD in public health science, as a person who has studied this for years, thousands of hours, I would be one of the first persons to testify, which I have under oath, to challenge the safety and efficacy of virtually all the vaccines currently used. And if you want to see that testimony challenging the entire medical board of the state of New York, it's on YouTube, and you'll see how I took on the issue, the facts I had, and the lack of facts they had. Everything seems like it's right until you get to the closeness of it. But anyhow, I'm not here to argue this issue with you. I'm here to learn, as my audience is, from you with your deep and varied experience. So I apologize if we got distracted there for a moment.
Right. Let me try to put this into perspective, at least from my perspective, which anybody is free to disagree with. The vaccine issue is an important issue. However, it's not the issue that motivates and drives the child welfare system. The child welfare system is not, in my opinion, really concerned about what vaccinations children get and don't get. Our days are taken up by children who don't wear clean diapers, who have diaper rash that's been lasting for weeks and weeks and weeks, malnourished children, children who aren't enrolled in school, children who don't have the basic minimum of medical care and are just growing up in the most horrendous situations. So in my opinion, the vaccine issue, while it's a very important one, or it could be an important one in a certain circumstances, it's not something that takes up a whole lot of time in child welfare offices. In other words, social workers aren't saying to themselves, geez, I wonder who isn't vaccinating their child, or I wonder if this vaccination is really working or not working. Instead, they're inundated with telephone calls coming in 24 hours a day about children that are being left unattended, children that aren't in school, children that don't get three meals a day, children that don't have glasses, children whose teeth are rotting out. That's what child welfare is like in the United States right now. So
I would agree with that, and I think it's noble that you're focusing on this. My follow-up question for you, if you would, please. Why is this system not working to the ideal that it should for the children, and what do you believe is necessary to repair it?
I wish I had the answer to that, but unfortunately, what we have found out is that it takes a tremendous amount of resources to address any of these issues, because caring properly for children is a very expensive proposition. In other words, to properly educate, clothe, feed, care for, provide medical care for children is a very expensive proposition. And a lot of families save, they sacrifice, they do what they need to do to provide the best that they possibly can for their children. But as a nation, this country doesn't seem to be willing to provide the monetary resources, the financial resources that we need. And one of the ways you can illustrate this is what's known as the child in the well. When a child falls down in the well, the world stops, everybody rushes over to the hole in the ground, and they spend hundreds of thousands of dollars to get the child out of the well. We should bring that sort of sense of urgency to these 22% of the children who have, in essence, fallen down a well. Why don't those children, hundreds of thousands, millions of children growing up in poverty, get the same sort of time and attention that the one single child who falls down in the well gets? For some reason, the political will isn't there. We just don't seem to have the focus of attention to devote the resources to this. We spend billions of dollars on aircraft carriers, jet planes, weaponry, highways, doing all kinds of different things, but 22% of children are in poverty. Schools lack books. The schools are falling down. Children don't get proper health care. And, you know, you talk about the ideal caseload for a social worker is 17, and a lot of different systems, the social worker is carrying 2, 3, 4 times as many children. Whose fault is that? I mean, the child welfare system theoretically knows how to deliver good child welfare services. When you cut their budget, it's just not going to be there. So caring for children, protecting children, I mean, Mr. Bryant wrote this book about exploited children, and I have no reason to doubt that everything he said is the way it happened. My question is, who was watching out for those children? Why wasn't anybody watching out for their children? Were these children in foster care? Where were their social workers? Where were their guardian ad litem? Where were their attorneys? Were they adopted? Who did the adoption home study? Who screened these people? The system broke down somewhere, and sometimes the system breaks down because people are inept, they're incompetent, they don't care, and sometimes the system doesn't work because it's totally overloaded and the funding just isn't there.
All valid points, and I thank you for making those. Nick, let's pick it up. Answer Harvey's concerns, because we need to know what was going on that allowed for so many years very powerful people to be able to exploit these children. Give us more background on how it happened that nobody was paying attention, or if those who did pay attention were kept from doing their jobs.
Well, I want to chime in on Harvey's point, too. First of all, that it's really the situation is really, really dire as far as, like, the funding programs for children. And when our society, when in 2032, we're going to have two workers per retiree, and 22% of those children right now are growing up in poverty. So our society is really setting itself up for a disaster. And now getting back to the Franklin scandal, I know that the Franklin scandal, the message of the Franklin scandal is very counterintuitive, because people would think that everyone is going to care for the children and make sure that the children aren't abused. But in this situation, I think that there were a couple of variables involved. Harvey's point of there's a lot of children that are out there that the state is trying to take care of. It's very hard to take care of, to keep track of the thousands of kids that cycle through the foster care system or through other systems. And, but in this situation, unfortunately, in the Franklin scandal, there was malfeasance going on, with law enforcement, certainly with a pocket within the FBI in Omaha, the Omaha field office, was harassing people that were actually trying to, as I said earlier, there was a social worker who had a real bad feeling about one of these foster care homes, and she started to look into it. And she said to the state investigator that she was harassed by a couple of FBI agents that came down on her really hard, telling her not to look into this foster care home, that she should just mind her own business. And as the Franklin scandal kind of unfolds and this legislative committee forms, it's very obvious in my book that the FBI, or certain a pocket within the FBI, has a vested interest in completely covering this up. And I cite example after example after example where there was FBI malfeasance involved in covering up this child trafficking network. And I realize that it's a very difficult message for people to understand. And I mean, that's why I spent 7 years on the book. And because I really thought that I really had to nail the story, because it's a story that people don't want to believe, and it's a story that people don't even want to contemplate. So I really felt that I had to really raise the bar as far as the amount of evidence and corroboration
Nick,
that
Nick,
I collected.
You certainly have some support by many people in this audience, because as difficult as it was for social worker or others who saw what was happening, heard the claims of the young children who were abused, and then saw powerful forces descend on them. Imagine the tens of thousands of children that were abused in the orphanages in Ireland, the laundries run by the Catholic Church for over 100 years that only closed in 1996. Imagine the enormous abuse of the young boys by the pedophile priests, of which there were thousands of priests engaged. They've settled for several billion dollars in cash to these victims, and many only coming forward much later, because when asked, some of these victims said, when I originally went to the people, I went to the nun, I went to the priest, I went to different people, nobody wanted to believe me. No one could believe this was possible. Now we know that this current just retired Ratzinger was the chief cardinal, and he was the overseer of this entire scandal and facilitated moving a lot of these priests away from where they were and getting them out of harm's way, and kept this covered up. This scandal is not going to go away. I believe now that new information is coming out that we're only going to reveal more of it. But imagine, who would have believed? Who would have believed in the 1940s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s that such a scandal could occur? Now, we're talking about an institutional disgrace, not a lone orphanage, not a lone boys' house someplace. We're talking about massive amounts of abuse, and yet it was covered up, nothing was done about it, and you have yet to see those responsible for covering it up getting prosecuted, and that's unfortunate. Your final thoughts on that, Nick?
Since I've been since I started the Franklin scandal 10 years ago, started researching the Franklin scandal 10 years ago, power broker pedophile networks have been covered up in Mexico, Venezuela, Portugal, and also Belgium and Australia. So this is not a phenomena that is, the vast majority of children that get abused sexually are abused by family members. As I said earlier, it's about 16%. But there are these power broker pedophile networks that are in operation throughout Western society. And until people really understand that these networks exist, it's like a disease. You cannot cure a disease until it's been diagnosed. And these networks have basically gone unnoticed and unreported. And the amount of trouble that I've had trying to get the Franklin scandal into popular culture and have it picked up by various news and information agencies has been very, very difficult. It's just a message that people don't want to embrace. And as long as people are going to live in denial about that particular message, these networks are going to continue unabated.
Nick Bryant, thank you very much for being with us. The website is franklinscandal.com. And Harvey Schweitzer, thank you very much for your input. We appreciate it. The website is schweitzerlaw.net. I appreciate both of you being on today. My final thought is, isn't the status of our children today an indication of who Americans are as a nation and who we are as a nation if compassion and social assistance is not written into our culture and we can't take care of our own children? Thank you very much for listening. I'm Gary Noll.